Vixen 03 by Clive Cussler. This book is read by Michael Pritchard. Oblivion. Buckley Field, Colorado, January 1954. The Boeing C-97 Stratocruiser bore the look of a crypt. Perhaps the image was bred by the cold winter night, or perhaps it came from the gusting snow that was piling an icy shroud on the wings and fuselage. The flickering lights from the cockpit windshield and the fleeting shadows of the maintenance crew served only to exaggerate the chilling scene. Major Raymond Vilander, United States Air Force, did not care for what he saw. He watched silently as the fuel truck drove away and vanished into the stormy darkness. The loading ramp was dropped from the rear of the great whale-like belly, and then the cargo doors slowly swung closed, cutting off a rectangle of light that spilled onto a heavy-duty forklift. He shifted his gaze slightly and stared at the twin rows of white lights bordering the 11,000-foot Buckley Naval Air Station runway that stretched across the plains of Colorado. Their ghostly luminescence marched into the night and gradually faded behind the curtain of falling snow. He refocused his eyes and studied the weary face reflected in the window pane. His cap was pushed carelessly back, revealing a dense thicket of umber hair. His shoulders were hunched forward, and he wore the taut look of a 100 meters runner poised for the starter's gun. His transparent reflection, bleeding through the glass into that of the aircraft in the background, caused him to shiver involuntarily. He closed his eyes, pushed the scene into the far reaches of his mind, and refaced the room. Admiral Walter Bass, who sat on the edge of a desk, neatly folded a meteorological chart, then patted his sweating forehead with a handkerchief and nodded at Vilander. "The weather front is moving off the eastern slope of the Rockies. You should break out of the overcast somewhere over the Continental Divide. Providing I can get that big-ass bird off the ground." "You'll do it." Lifting a heavy plane with a full fuel load and a cargo weighing 70,000 pounds in the middle of a blizzard with a 30-knot crosswind from a ground altitude of 5,000 feet isn't exactly a garden-variety takeoff. "Every factor has been carefully considered," Bass said coldly. "Your wheel should leave the earth with a margin of 3,000 feet of runway to spare." Vilander dropped into a chair like a deflated balloon. "Is it worth risking the necks of my crew, Admiral? Just what is so damned vital to the U.S. Navy that it has to drag an Air Force plane out in the middle of nowhere in the dead of night to haul some junk to an island in the Pacific Ocean?" For a moment, Bass's face flushed, and then it softened. When he spoke, it was gently, almost apologetically. "It's painfully simple, Major. That junk, as you call it, is a top-priority cargo destined for a highly classified test program. Since your Stratocruiser was the only heavy transport within 1,000 miles that can do the job, the Air Force consented to put her on temporary loan to the Navy. They threw you and your crew into the bargain, and that's all there is to it." Vilander shot Bass a penetrating stare. "I don't mean to sound insubordinate, Admiral, but that's not all, not by a long shot." Bass walked around the desk and sat down. "You're to consider it a routine flight, nothing more. I'd appreciate it, sir, if you'd throw me a bone and enlighten me as to what's inside those canisters in my cargo cabin." Bass avoided his eyes. "Sorry, it's highly classified material." Vilander knew when he was licked. He swayed wearily to his feet, picked up the vinyl folder containing his flight plan and charts, and walked toward the door. Then he hesitated and turned. "In the event we have to ditch..." "Don't." "If an in-flight emergency develops," Bass said solemnly, "you ride her down into a non-populated area." "That's asking too much." "I'm not making a formal request. I'm giving you an order. You and your crew are not to abandon the aircraft between here and your destination, regardless of how dire the circumstances." Vilander's face clouded. "Then I guess that's it." "There is one more thing."
"Which is?"
"Good luck," Bass said, his lips edging into a tight grin. It was a grin Vilander didn't like, not one tiny bit. He pulled open the door and, without replying, walked out into the cold. In the control cabin, slouched so far down that the back of his head rested a good foot below his headrest, Lieutenant Sam Gold, Vylander's co-pilot, preoccupied himself with a flight checklist, while behind him, off to his left, Captain George Hoffman, the crew's navigator, fiddled with a plastic protractor. Neither man paid the slightest acknowledgement to Vylander as he stepped through the bulkhead door leading from the cargo cabin. "Course plotted?" Vylander inquired of Hoffman. "All the preliminary dirty work has been figured by the Navy experts. Can't say as I agree with their choice of scenic routes, though. They've got us flying over the most desolate country in the West." A worried expression came over Vylander's face, which didn't go unnoticed by Hoffman. The Major looked over his shoulder at the huge metal canisters strapped down in the cargo section and tried to summon up a vision of their contents. His contemplation was interrupted by the Buster Keaton deadpan face of Master Sergeant Joe Burns, the flight engineer, peering around the cabin door. "All buttoned up and ready for the wild blue yonder, Major." Vylander nodded without taking his eyes off the sinister-looking canisters. "Okay, let's put this chamber of horrors on the road." The first engine turned over and sputtered to life, followed quickly by the other three. Then the auxiliary power unit was unplugged, the chocks holding the wheels were pulled, and Vylander began taxiing the overburdened aircraft toward the end of the main runway. The security guards and the maintenance crew turned away and scurried for the warmth of a nearby hangar as the prop wash lashed their backs. Admiral Bass stood in the Buckley control tower and watched the Stratocruiser crawl like a pregnant bug across the snow-swept field. A phone was clutched in his hand, and he spoke quietly into the receiver. "You may inform the President that Vixen 03 is preparing for takeoff." "When do you figure its estimated time of arrival?" asked the stern voice of Charles Wilson, Secretary of Defense, through the earpiece. "Allowing for a fuel stop at Hickam Field in Hawaii, Vixen 03 should touch down in the test area approximately 1400 hours Washington time." "Ike has scheduled us for 0800 hours tomorrow. He insists on a detailed briefing of the upcoming experiments and a running report on Vixen 03's flight progress." "I'll take off for Washington immediately." "I don't have to paint you a picture, Admiral, of what would happen if that plane crashed in or near a major city." Bass hesitated in what seemed a long and terrible silence. "Yes, Mr. Secretary, it would indeed be a nightmare none of us could live with." "The manifold pressure and the torque read a shade low across the board," announced Sergeant Burns. He watched over the engineer's panel with the intensity of a ferret. "Enough to abort?" Gold asked hopefully. "Sorry, Lieutenant. Internal combustion engines won't perform in the thin mountain air of Denver like they will at sea level. Considering the altitude, the gauge readings are par for the course." Vylander gazed at the strip of asphalt ahead. The snowfall had lightened, and he could almost see the halfway marker. His heart began to throb a little faster, keeping time with the rapid beat of the windshield wipers. "God," he thought to himself, "it looks no bigger than a shuffleboard court." As if in a trance, he reached over and picked up his hand mic. "Buckley Control, this is Vixen 03, ready to roll. Over." "She's all yours, Vixen 03, the familiar voice of Admiral Bass scratched through the headphones. "Save a big-chested native girl for me." Vylander simply signed off, released the brakes, and shoved the four throttles against their stops. The C-97 pushed her bulbous nose into the blowing snow and began her struggle down the long ribbon of pavement as Gold began calling out the increasing ground speed in a monotone. 50 knots. All too soon, an illuminated sign with a large number 9 flashed by. 9,000 feet to go, Gold droned. Ground speed 70. The white runway lights blurred past the wingtips. The Stratocruiser lunged onward, the powerful Pratt Whitney engines straining in their mounts, their four-bladed propellers clawing at the rarefied air. Vylander's hands were cemented to the wheel. his knuckles twisted white, his lips murmuring intermingled prayers and curses. 100 knots, 7,000 feet left. Burns's eyes never left his instrument panel, studying every twitch of the gauge needles, ready to detect the first signs of trouble. Hoffman could do nothing but sit there helplessly and watch the runway dissolve at what seemed to him an excessive rate of speed. 125. Bylander was fighting the controls now, as the vicious crosswind attacked the control surfaces. A trickle of sweat rolled unnoticed down his left cheek and dropped into his lap. Grimly, he waited for some sign indicating that the craft was beginning to lighten. But it still felt as though a giant hand were pushing against the cabin's roof. 135 knots. Kiss the 5,000-foot marker. Farewell. Lift, baby, lift, Hoffman pleaded as Gold's readings began falling one on top of the other. 145 knots. 3,000 feet left. He turned to Vilander. We just passed the go-no-go point. So much for Admiral Bass's safety margin, Vilander muttered. 2,000 feet coming up. Ground speed 155. Vilander could see the red lights at the end of the runway. It felt as though he were steering a rock. Gold kept glancing at him nervously, anticipating the movement of the elbows that meant the Major had engaged the controls for the climb. Vilander sat still, as immovable as a sack of Portland cement. Oh God, the 1,000-foot marker. Going, going, gone. Vilander gently eased back the control column. For almost 3 seconds, which seemed an eternity, nothing happened. But then, with agonizing slowness, the Stratocruiser slipped the ground and staggered aloft a scant 50 yards before the asphalt stopped. "Gear up," he said hoarsely. There were a few uneasy moments until the landing gear thumped inside their wheel wells and Vilander could feel a slight increase in airspeed. "Gear up and locked," said Gold. The flaps were raised at 400 feet, and the men in the cabin expelled a great collective sigh of relief as Vilander banked into a shallow turn to the northwest. The lights of Denver blinked beneath the port wing, but quickly became lost as the overcast closed in. Vilander didn't relax fully until the airspeed crept over 200 knots, and the altimeter showed 3,500 feet between the plane and the ground. "Up, up and away," sighed Hoffman. "I don't mind admitting I had a couple of tiny doubts there for a while." "Join the club," said Burns, grinning. As soon as he broke through the clouds and leveled the Stratocruiser out at 16,000 feet on a westerly heading over the Rockies, Vilander motioned to Gold. "Take her. I'm going to make a check aft." Gold looked at him. The Major did not normally relinquish the controls so early in the flight. "Got her," Gold acknowledged, placing his hands on the yoke. Vilander released his seat belt and shoulder harness and stepped into the cargo section, making sure the door to the cockpit was closed behind him. He counted 36 of the gleaming stainless steel canisters, firmly strapped to wooden blocks on the deck. He began carefully checking the surface area of each canister. He searched for the usual stenciled military markings denoting weight, date of manufacture, inspector's initials, handling instructions. There were none. After nearly 15 minutes, he was about to give up and return to the cockpit when he spotted a small aluminum plate that had fallen down between the blocks. It had an adhesive backing, and Vilander felt a tinge of smugness as he matched it to a sticky spot of stainless steel where it had once been bonded. He held the plate up to the dim cabin light and squinted at its smooth side. The tiny engraved marking confirmed his worst fear. He stood for a time, staring at the little aluminum plate. Suddenly, he was jolted out of his reverie by a lurch of the aircraft. He rushed across the cargo cabin and threw open the door to the cockpit. It was filled with smoke. "Oxygen masks," Vilander shouted. He could barely make out the outlines of Hoffman and Burns. Gold was completely enveloped in the bluish haze. He groped his way to the pilot's seat and fumbled for his oxygen mask, wincing at the acrid smell of an electrical short circuit. "Buckley Tower, this is Vixen 03," Gold was yelling into a microphone. "We have smoke in the cockpit. Request emergency landing instructions. Over. Taking over the controls, said Vilander. She's yours. Gold's acceptance came without hesitation. Burns?
Sir?
What in hell's gone wrong?
Can't tell for sure with all this smoke, Major.
Burns's voice sounded hollow under the oxygen mask.
It looks like a short in the area of the radio transmitter.
Buckley Tower, this is Vixen 03, Gold persisted. Please come in.
It's no use, Lieutenant, Burns gasped. They can't hear you.
Nobody can hear you. The circuit breaker for the radio equipment won't stay set. Vilander's eyes were watering so badly he could hardly see.
I'm bringing her around on a course back to Buckley, he announced calmly.
But before he could complete the 180-degree turn, the C-97 started to vibrate abruptly in unison with a metallic ripping sound. The smoke disappeared as if by magic, and a frigid blast of air tore into the small enclosure, assailing the men's exposed skin like 1,000 wasps. The plane was shaking herself to pieces.
Number 3 engine threw a propeller blade, Burns cried.
Jesus Christ, it never rains. Shut down 3, snapped Vilander, and feather what's left of the prop. Gold's hands flew over the control panel, and soon the vibration ceased. His heart sinking, Vilander gingerly tested the controls. His breath quickened, and a growing dread mushroomed inside him. The prop blade ripped through the fuselage, Hoffman reported. There's a 6-foot gash in the cargo cabin wall. Cables and hydraulic lines are dangling all over.
That explains where the smoke went, Gold said wryly.
It was sucked outside when we lost cabin pressure.
It also explains why the ailerons and rudder won't respond, Vilander added. We can go up and we can go down, but we can't turn and bank.
Maybe we can slew her around by opening and closing the cowl flaps on engines 1 and 4, Gold suggested.
At least enough to put us in the landing pattern at Buckley.
We can't make Buckley, Vilander said. Without number 3 engine, we're losing altitude at a rate of nearly 100 feet a minute. We're going to have to set her down in the Rockies. His announcement was greeted with stunned silence. He could see the fear grow in his crew members' eyes, could almost smell it.
My God, groaned Hoffman, it can't be done. We'll ram the side of a mountain for sure.
We've still got power and some measure of control, Vilander said, and we're out of the overcast, so we can at least see where we're going.
Thank heaven for small favors, grunted Burns.
What's our heading? Asked Vilander.
227 southwest, answered Hoffman.
We've been thrown almost 80 degrees off our plotted course.
Vilander merely nodded. There was nothing more to say.
He turned all his concentration to keeping the stratocruiser on a lateral level. But there was no stopping the rapid descent. Even with full power settings on the remaining 3 engines, there was no way the heavily laden plane could maintain altitude. He and Gold could only sit by impotently as they began a long glide earthward through the valleys surrounded by the 14,000-foot peaks of the Colorado Rockies. Soon they could make out the trees poking through the snow coating the mountains. At 11,500 feet, the jagged summits began rising above their wingtips. Gold flicked on the landing lights and strained his eyes through the windshield, searching for an open piece of ground. Hoffman and Burns sat frozen, tensed for the inevitable crash. The altimeter needle dipped below the 10,000-foot mark. 10,000 feet. It was a miracle they had made it so low. A miracle a wall of rock had not risen suddenly and blocked their glide path. Then, almost directly ahead, the trees parted and the landing lights revealed a flat, snow-covered field.
A meadow, Gold shouted. A gorgeous, beautiful alpine meadow 5 degrees to starboard.
I see it, acknowledged Vilander. He coaxed the slight course adjustment out of the stratocruiser by jockeying the engine cowl flaps and throttle settings. There was no time for the formality of a checklist run-through. It was to be a do-or-die approach, textbook wheels-up landing. The sea of trees disappeared beneath the nose of the cockpit, and Gold cut off the ignition and electrical circuits as Vilander stalled the stratocruiser a scant 10 feet above the ground. The 3 remaining engines died, and the great dark shadow below quickly rose and converged upon the falling fuselage. The impact was far less brutal than any of them had a right to expect. The belly kissed the snow and bumped lightly, once, twice, and then settled down like a giant ski,
How long the harrowing, uncontrolled ride continued, Vilander could not tell. The short seconds passed like minutes. And then the fallen aircraft slid clumsily to a stop, and there was a deep silence, deathly still and ominous. Burns was the first to react.
"By God, we did it," he murmured through trembling lips.
Gold stared ashen-faced into the windshield. His eyes saw only white. An impenetrable blanket of snow had been piled high against the glass. Slowly he turned to Vilander and opened his mouth to say something, but the words never came. They died in his throat. A rumbling vibration suddenly shook the Stratocruiser, followed by a sharp crackling noise and the tortured screech of metal being bent and twisted. The white outside the windows dissolved into a dense wall of cold blackness, and then there was nothing. Nothing at all. At his naval headquarters office in Washington, Admiral Bass vacantly studied a map indicating Vixen 03's scheduled flight path. It was all there in his tired eyes, the deeply etched lines on his pale, sunken cheeks, the weary slump of his shoulders. In the past 4 months, Bass had aged far beyond his years. The desk phone rang, and he picked it up.
"Admiral Bass," came a familiar voice.
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Secretary Wilson tells me you wish to call off the search for Vixen 03.
"That's true," Bass said quietly. "I see no sense in prolonging the agony. Navy surface craft, Air Force search planes, and Army ground units have combed every inch of land and sea for 50 miles along either side of Vixen 03's plotted course."
"What's your opinion?"
"My guess is her remains are resting on the seabed of the Pacific Ocean," answered Bass.
"You feel she made it past the West Coast?"
"I do."
"Let us pray you're right, Admiral. God help us if she crashed on land."
"If she had, we'd have known by now," Bass said.
"Yes," the President hesitated. "I guess we would at that."
Another pause. "Close the file on Vixen 03. Bury it, and bury it deep."
"I'll see to it, Mr. President."
Bass set the receiver in its cradle and sank back in his chair, a defeated man at the end of a long and otherwise distinguished Navy career. He stared at the map again.
"Where?" he said aloud to himself.
"Where are you?
Where in hell did you go?"
The answer never came. No clue to the disappearance of the ill-fated Stratocruiser ever turned up. It was as though Major Vilander and his crew had flown into oblivion.